class, and I'll say it again, let me describe it in a little different terms. As we hit this period following the Reformation, you kind of have an explosion of groups that come on the scene, and various, some of these groups will start and stop. Some of them will carry through and come out the other end looking a little bit like they started. Some of them will morph along the way, and you'll see all of that as we go through these lessons. As we get into the Congregationalist, which is really in a way a descriptive term, but it's the term they began to be called by, we get introduced to the Puritans, the English Puritans. We're still in England. We get, in England, we go jump across the pond, we come back, but we're back in England now. And you may recall we left off with Elizabeth being on the throne, that she was trying to clear out the absolute following of the church there as the following the Catholic Church, I guess, the best way to say it, even though she was maybe a Catholic, maybe a Protestant, really hard to tell what she was, but she did try to clear out the overall influence of the power of the Pope. But in doing so, you had this group that rose up that came to be called the Puritans. And the Puritans, as a generic class, wanted to, as the name might imply, wanted to purify the Church of England. That was really their objective to start off with. And they were of the mind that really up until 1570 or so, that the liturgy of the church was just too much like the Catholic Church, too popish to them, to use a phrase. And so they wanted to see that changed, all the rituals, and they would add to that as time went on. They wanted to get rid of the saints' days, clerical absolution, sign of the cross, godparents, kneeling for prayer, and the use of the various gowns of that the vestments that the priests and the bishops, whatever they were in the Church of England, would wear. So they were against that. And furthermore, evidently the Anglican church members were rather loose on their attendance, and they didn't think that was right either. As an aside, Cambridge as a university in England actually became a center of the intellectual group for the Puritans, and where the Puritans had quite a bit of influence. And partly, in part because of that, you would see lawyers that were converted over, merchants, so-called gentry, the property owner type people. A number of these were Puritans. Elizabeth, she kind of put the influence of the Pope aside or down, but at the same time she's getting this pressure from the Puritans. So in the latter part of the 1500s, she passed an act that said Puritans had to attend Anglican Church, Church of England. And if they didn't, they would be in prison. And so a number of them were because of that. The Puritans, there are three terms that you use when you're talking about this period. No, really, four when you talk about this period. One is independence. Another is Puritans. Another is a separatist. And another is congregationalists. And those terms were applied to different groups and different mixes. They were all could be considered independents, and really most of them could be considered Puritans in the sense they wanted to change the Church of England in some fashion, but some of them wanted to stay with the church, some of them didn't. And so you get this separatist group. So that's a little bit in the way of just some background. You find that the Puritans that would be in, as I mentioned, in kind of two broad categories, those who want to make change from within and those who wanted to separate from the church altogether and follow this congregational nature of the church that believed that you should not have a church state, which is what existed. And then there's a list of concerns in your notes I've talked about. The Congregationalists that we'll find both in England and really in America and the Baptists came out of the English Separatist movement, the part of this group that wanted to separate. And we'll see that as we go through this, hopefully through this flowchart. If you look at the flowchart for a minute, one of the early things about one of the early developments among the Puritans goes out where you see this Thomas Cartwright Presbyterian dropping down. Cartwright was one of those. He led a group who wanted to see a Presbyterian type of a government, and so he started a group away from the Church of England, leading in that direction. And we'll cover that in more detail in a later lesson. The other one that was involved was a fellow named Henry Jacob. You'll see that right next to him. And Jacob ended up going over in Holland, Leiden, in 1606, for about 10 years, and then he comes back to England in the 1600s, in 1616, and we'll talk about that as well a little bit further on. And neither one of these groups were really considered themselves separatists. They didn't want to particularly separate. But what occurred is that because of persecution, they ended up effectively doing that. Congregationalism as a general category really got its, first advocate, in a fellow named Robert Brown. And Harrison did want to separate. They thought the organization of a church state was wrong, and therefore they wanted to break off and see congregations exist. And so they started a group with them that went to Norwich, or didn't go to, they were in Norwich, and started a church there with that group. And Brown wrote something that you may or may not have ever heard of, a treatise of Reformation without tearing for any, and it was really something that set out his views. So he was a fellow who was a writer and had influence on people. But if you look at the flowchart I give you, you'll see he kind of dash. Basically, that group of Brown started didn't go anywhere. Further on down in time, he ended up while he had views about what constituted a true church, he ended up going back and coming under the Archbishop of one of the towns there, one of the churches there, in the latter part of the 1500s. And so he really spent the rest of his life was kind of in obscurity, and except for the fact that he was a writer, and his writings had influence. Not so much that he started any particular group that lived on, but his writings around church independence from the state and the idea of being obedient to Christ as opposed to being obedient to some church organization were ideas that would influence this development of these Congregationalists throughout time. I've listed for you what his congregational principles were as he stated them. It was kind of interesting. One and two, the only church is a local body of believers in Christ, and united to Him and one another by a voluntary covenant, and that such a church has Christ as its immediate head. And so there, you know, you see in 1 and 2, you see a little bit of confusion about what is it, what's the universal church and the local church. But this follows on the idea, you think back about the Catholics, that they didn't make a distinction either. They were the universal church, and here on earth, and that's some of, you see some of that influence even in Brown. He said each church was self-governing, and he chooses pastor, teacher, elders, and you know, the idea of a pastor being a separate office shows up in his writings, and churches were to be autonomous. And that's one of the principles behind the Congregationalists. Is you covenant together as a local group, you are autonomous. And that doesn't mean that you didn't cooperate, because they would cooperate, more so as time goes on. But they viewed themselves as autonomous. So that he did some of the early writing and influencing, longer term even, from what he wrote. You have then another group that broke out, and this was under John Greenwood and Harry Beryl. And again, if you look at the flow charts, you'll see it. They ended up, and they were, again, they were separatists as well. They ended up going over to Amsterdam, but that group would eventually dissipate as well. It turns out that both of these guys were hanged because of their views. And one of the things I thought about is during Craig's prayer, you know, you look at people who may have these views, and we see that, you know, from looking at the Bible, see the error in their views. But one thing you have to give these men and women, you just don't hear about the women, men and women credit for, is they had conviction. And they were willing to give their life for that conviction. And you'll see that over and over again in the people that lived in this time frame, standing up for their beliefs and giving their life for it. So in any event, that group did not... They had a fellow that, and I listed his name there, Johnson. He went over to... He was actually over in Holland as well. But they really never amounted to much beyond just that small group. Then there was another group that showed up, and you'll see that under Gainsborough, John Smith, and Scrooby, which would end up having John Robinson involved in it. And these, again, these both were separatist groups. One of them, the one that was in Scrooby, would end up in Holland, in Leon, Holland, in 1608. And there's a fellow named Bradford. Now, my history is not so good, but William Bradford, for those of you who have been in school more recently than I have been, William Bradford was one of the members of the group that came over on the Mayflower, and was, I believe, he was governor at one time. And so this group from Scrooby are the ones that are going to migrate as the 100 or so people that came across on the Mayflower, the so-called, what we refer to as the Pilgrims. The Gainsborough group was, like all these groups tended to be, migrated to Amsterdam. And in migrating to Amsterdam, as they were there, there were actually two people associated with it of name, one being Smith, and another one being Helwes, that were involved in the Amsterdam work. And they came under the influence of some Mennonites. And a little bit of history on Smith. Smith ended up baptizing himself. Kind of always reminds me of Steve Rudd when you hear about him. But he baptized himself and several other members, who Helwes included, about 30, 35 of them, by pouring. And then after he got introduced to the Mennonites, he started thinking about questioning his baptism. That is to say, he thought it was okay he was baptized by himself unless there was a true church where he could be baptized. So he was of the mindset, I don't know what his total logic was, that it took some right organization, a person from a right organization to baptize him. The baptizer was as important as the baptizee. So he got interested in the Mennonite group. As time would go on, not all of the group that was with him, who Helwes and Smith, would be interested in that group, would be interested in being that closely associated with the Mennonites. Smith wanted to stay with them and did work to be involved with that group. But the Helwes group were not in favor of that. They ended up going back to England and would end up being the group that would form or lead to the so-called general English General Baptist. Going back to just a minute to the group out of Scrooby that would go over in the Mayflower. They had, of course, they, as we know from American history, they had a tough time when they first got here, but they would survive and grow. And subsequent to them being there, another group, much larger group, would show up. And these were also Puritans. And they would show up, and it was a group that would start, be associated with the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And so they settled in Boston, first of all, and spread around. The difference between this group and the Scrooby group, the Mayflower group, was this group was a non-separatist group, where the Mayflower group was a separatist group. And so you had, even though they were all Puritans, they had different views about things. But the Massachusetts Bay Party was much larger, and so it would religiously be the ones that tended to have the most influence during this period of time. And so as they stayed in America, they founded a number of congregational churches in America that were this non-separatist Puritan view. And I think there was something like, if memory serves me, like 300 or 400, 300 congregations in New England, Congregationalist congregations that derived their genesis out of this, mainly this group, at the time of the Revolution, when it would come along. In spite of the separation, non-separation issue, the beliefs of a lot of these groups were basically the same. It's just a question of to what degree could they have impact on the Church of England. So they separated, and this is true in the case even of the non-separatist group that came over. They separated because they had persecution. But spiritually, they wanted to be, or religiously, they wanted to be linked back and stay in contact, or stay, view themselves as having their spiritual lineage from the Church of England. So you have all of you have these two groups showing up in America, and they are your Congregationalists, and it end up being what is the primary church in the colonies, that and the Episcopal Church at the time of the Revolution.
Did you find it listed like their line of faith on was Christ God?
They were all Trinitarians. They all believed in, as I say, local autonomy. they believed in congregations being, or churches as they would call them, as we would call them, local churches being established by people coveted, believers coveting together. They practiced believer baptism, but it wasn't necessarily, in fact, in most cases it wasn't at all, immersion. It was going to be pouring. And we'll see there are different, they had different theologies that would evolve with time, being general, being whether or not you call it a general Baptist or when it comes to these all these groups, general Baptist or a particular Baptist or the kind of congregationalist, where they did they believe, to what degree did they believe in aspects of Calvinism, to what degree did they didn't, would vary in some cases.
Are you going to high church and low church? Are you
going to
comment on this?
I wasn't planning on it. This goes, I'm not even sure. Remember, we talked about high church, low church, Episcopal. I think it was Episcopal. Mm-hmm. We talked about Episcopal. And that was the Protestant thrust versus the attitude-wise, Protestant attitude versus a Catholic attitude. These two developments in over time, they just disappeared because of liberal theology that came in. But, for this, I wasn't really going to make much of an issue out of it. Other than to say, you know, it looks like the vast majority of these end up coming out of the separating away from, because of their Protestant leanings.
Where does the Episcopal fall into this
book
chart?
It's entirely different. I mean, it's off the chart. It has its own line. It has no lineage, shares no lineage other than the Anglican Church. Shares no lineage. That's why I say when you get to New England in the 16, 1700s, you've got Episcopal churches. Depending on whether you're talking about before or after the Revolution. You've got actually congregations that are part of the Church of England, and then you've got Congregationalists coming over. You come up to the Revolution, and the Church of England people are the ones that set up the Episcopal Church of America. And so it would you would stop having Church of England, the Anglican Church in the U.S. and the strength that was there, it would be the Episcopal Church of the U.S. So that's one group. You have the Catholics, that's another group. And then you have Congregationalists, third group. Those are the major three groups that were in the colonies at the time.
Is there an Anglican Church in the United States today?
Is there any what?
Is there an Anglican Church in the United States
yes,
today?
Yes, there is.
And they're separate from the Episcopalians?
Yes. Well, let me describe that differently. Yes and no. They're part of the Episcopal. They're part of the so-called Anglican community. They're independent, but there's a worldwide Anglican community that communion they call it that would have the U.S. Episcopals in it, the Church of England, Church of England people in it. In various regions, like the Nigerian Anglicans, the one I'm familiar with, that are they're not synods, they view themselves as having an assembly, an assembly of churches, and they call themselves a communion.
Like a diocese or something?
No, it's bigger than a diocese. Bigger than a diocese. It's where dioceses come to dioceses, remember, come together and have general assembly and that kind of thing. They have a presiding bishop. That's in the U.S. You have a presiding bishop. Well, you have a presiding bishop with the Nigerian communion. You have the Archbishop of Canterbury. That's the Anglican Church. And that guy influences, because he's head of the Anglican Church, Anglican community, he has more, he's the bigger bishop among bishops. Okay. I'm sure all that's very clear to you. So you've got all the Congregationalists, and I guess, you know, early on I was mentioning you have this mix about, you know, Calvinists, non-Calvinists. Early on, most of these Congregationalists started out with a Calvinist theology, but that changed, and they would move to a relaxed Calvin theology, and then pretty soon, they just mixed aspects of the various theologies as well. You had a situation come up that is called as revival activity that happened. It's called the Great Awakening. And the Great Awakening occurred by a guy, it was led by a guy by the name of Jonathan Edwards. I'll say more about the detail of that in another lesson. But here's the point to be made in that. This is in the 1800s or the 1700s, actually, late 1700s. You have these Congregationalist churches that have a large component of Calvinistic theology. Well this fellow Jonathan Edwards ended up being a spearhead for a revival that went on around the country called the Great Awakening. And so they'd go out and preach that people should repent, and you had people responding to that and changing their life, and it gave the Congregationalists a lot of food for thought, because if you're strictly a Calvinistic theology, well, what's the point of preaching? What's the, you know, if you're expecting people to repent like they can make a choice, well, that's just counter to the whole Calvinistic view.
And so, how did Calvinism even continue from the start? I mean, you can make that argument from the very beginning of Calvinism.
I agree.
I knew you were going to argue
that. It's one of those things. I find it from a logical standpoint. I don't know how you defend it. I mean, I always find it difficult to defend.
Well, the defense would be that you're predestined to hear the word, so I have to preach the word to you in order for you to hear it.
Not if you really believe too, because you're going to be saved whether you hear the word or not, or God may make it available to you somehow. But if He decides you're going to be saved, you're going to be saved. You may even pick
up. But He's going to make it available to you.
I don't know. Maybe it's the Bible. Why does He have to? Why do you have to live a life that doesn't without sin? I mean, try not to sin.
I mean, we started arguing Tulip, and I know that's kind of off course, but they don't take it to that logical extreme, right?
You have to recognize, in all honesty, today you're going to find very, very, very small groups that are strict Calvinists. We think of the Baptist Church, for example. The Baptist Church is not strict Calvinist, far from it. And they exist. They're not predominant. So, and the vast majority now, I think this is a fair statement. The vast majority do not take. Even in the case of the particular Baptists we'll talk about, who hold to a particular atonement, that is, Christ only died for certain people, which speaks to a aspect in Calvinism of the unconditional election. Even they, with time, will change. No. Get off of that kick.
I found in some of my readings that the people who prescribed the Calvinism would say that they needed to preach the word because that was God's design on how those who are elected were called.
Right.
And that was how God set it up, that you still, there's a set number of people, but they still need to hear the word in order to have that irresistible grace come down upon them and, you know, fulfill their election.
I don't know why.
Yeah,
there's no reason why.
No choice.
That's an arbitrary. I'm not gonna argue. You're right. You know, that's an arbitrary explanation. Mm-hmm. Absolutely arbitrary.
I mean, everything's arbitrary explanations. That's how they. That's the logic that they follow to support that doctrine.
Yeah. I don't think everything's arbitrary logic.
It just was always
that happens to be arbitrary.
It was always interesting to me that those who would say they obeyed the gospel call were, they would consider themselves of the elect. You know, I mean, it was very convenient. And, you know, it's like there was nobody in here struggling with this, you know, trying to do what's right, and then them saying, well, I'm doing it just for fun because I'm not of the elect. You know, it's like, you're going to call yourself a Christian. Well, then, yeah, you're of the elect.
So, in order to establish the common will,
and are established what?
The Commonwealth.
Commonwealth.
The Great Commonwealth.
Of Massachusetts?
Yeah. Did they then believe that all of their members were predestined? Because they were separated from the... Or, not separated. Because of their group. They're going to form the state.
I wouldn't mix the politics with it.
Okay.
I can't take it there.
I find it difficult to even... go that direction.
Remember, these people were there, even the Massachusetts Bay group, all the Puritan groups, by and large, were there because of persecution back home. That's why they were there. That's where God started. And it wasn't because we think we're predestined to have a great something like that. I got pain. Let me get out of the pain. And I think, and no question from the, how did they live the religion, because they could live the religion that they had, the beliefs they had, they needed to be separate from the Church of England. What better place to do that than in a new country?
But they would persecute the Quakers, and the Quakers were not allowed to be a part of them, but the Baptists were. So, I mean, there was a government form.
I don't know. You're talking about things I'm not aware of. You say Quakers. Quakers.
That's why Quakers had to.
Quakers, Puritans, Brethren, these are all very similar beliefs. There's another group called the Dunkards, mm-hmm. which had to do with, as the name implies, it's a German group. Dunkards or Tunkards, either one. It has to do with cultural baptism.
Not to throw this discussion more off topic.
Well, I won't let you because I'll come right back on topic. But
we're very focused on the English the English influence on quote unquote Christianity in the United States. Are there going to be other influences? Like, do the French influence anything? Did Spanish influence anything? Or is everything basically...
What you have is the Western Europe ended up... Yeah, France is going to do... France is going to have a major impact. It's called... Religiously, it's called Catholicism. Spain's going to have a major impact. Portugal, it's called Catholicism. Why is South America Catholic?
Right.
Catholic, because of family.
Well, but that's South America, that's not the United States.
Why is South Louisiana Catholic?
Because of
the French.
Yeah,
no, I get that. There you are. And you have those influences. And a lot of water's gone over the dam under the British over time. So those influences came in, but they modified themselves. But you still have, because of immigration, in part because of immigration, you got the Irish immigration, you got a lot of Catholics. You got the German immigration, you got a lot of Lutherans. So there are influences that came over here because of immigration. The reason we focus on these things is because of organizations that, the religious organizations that we face, mainstream, I'm going to call them. In this day and age, you face a lot of other things. Primarily, the big one, I guess, we face is the Muslim religion now, but from a mainstream religion standpoint, so-called Christianity, these folks have their genesis, and these organizations have their genesis in Europe. And a lot of them have their genesis in, when you look at the body of people, in the English part of that, but not exclusively. We'll talk about the Lutherans, German. Evangelical and Reformed, you may run into in your notes here, that's German, the Reformed part. So there's other people. When you talk about the Congregationalists early on, unlike the Episcopalians, which were, before there was a U.S. Episcopal Church, the clergy had given an oath to follow the king, and so you had mixed bag on support of the revolution. Well, among the Congregationalists, there wasn't a mixed support. They, by and large, this was right down their alley. They supported the revolution as people, and they didn't. Whether the quote churches supported or just the people in it, I can't get that fine tuned. As I was mentioning this, the Great Awakening. It did cause, because it was a revivalist nature and people were going out and preaching, you needed to repent, i.e. you need to make a choice, and it was viewed that way. Saying, wait a minute, people can make choice. That gives this congregational, Calvinistic, strict Calvinistic view, gave them difficulty. And as a result of that and other things, they started modifying their beliefs. And liberalizing their beliefs in modern vernacular. If you look at the Congregational Church today, modern Congregationalist Church, a lot of the churches, we're going to talk about the Unitarians and Unitarian Universalists in another lesson. But the Unitarians impact on Congregationalists, and some of them would convert over. There were a number of them that didn't, and in spite of that, they became more liberal in their theology, and so you ended up seeing a number of them began to see Christianity in a different light. I guess you'd say they interpreted the Bible less literally than their predecessors had. They began to adopt some of the discarded worship practices that had existed and they had tried to get away from, that is, these liturgical, thank you. get my tongue stuck again. Sorry?
Craig said it first.
I taught my son well, I just can't remember what I taught him. And you see the Congregationalists being very active in social activities. They were one of the first ones, one of the very active ones in the abolition of slavery back in the 1800s. They ended up having the first woman ever ordained as a, quote, Christian minister of some sort. This came out of the Congregationalist groups. And they were big into, along with the Baptists at the time, big into the social movement, social gospel came along. In the 20th century, there were a number of mergers. And I've listed some of these, and maybe all of them in your notes. Congregational churches formed a national body. Remember, they separated out originally to get away from a national body, a national church. But their view is going to be, as a Congregationalist, they're autonomous, but they got to get together as groups to talk about issues, none of which are binding on them. Then that was the original thought, anyway. In 1931, the National Council of Congregational Churches merged with the General Convention of the Christian Church, and now we got something called the General Council of Congregational Christian Churches. That's a mouthful. Then a few years later, you had another merger, and that group would merge with the Evangelical and Reformed group, which was German Heritage I was talking about before. And Evangelical Reform, I'm from Louisville, and y'all may have never heard of Enar. In Louisville, Evangelical and Reformed, there were a number of those churches you'd find, because Louisville is has a history of German settlers. And Evangelical and Reformed itself, as the name sort of implies, is made up of Evangelical Church and a Reformed Church group that combined at some point in time.
And they call themselves the Church of Christ, Evangelical and Reformed.
Yep. And the interesting thing about it, they had certain affinities with Congregationalists, but they didn't accept the autonomy of the local congregation, which is sort of the bedrock of the Congregationalists. And so in spite of that, they managed to live together. This merger I was talking about eventually completed, and that is it formed something called the United Church of Christ. Anybody know what the United Church of Christ is? Does that ring a bell with anybody?
Heard of it.
You heard of your president? Remember Jeremiah Wright? Was that his name?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This group, United Church of Christ. That's what Jeremiah Wright was a preacher, and Barack Obama was the member back before he was elected president. And so, the modern, the Congregational Church of 1775 is not the Congregational Church of 2016. It's morphed considerably. Very liberal. I gave you an addendum in this lesson about a fellow named Bushnell. That's just to give you a sense of the kind of things that would come out of it. And you can have this kind of example of a lot of things, like groups where you get somebody that just goes off on a tangent somewhere. And he just went on a tangent, but he was a very popular guy. So he would take people with him as well. Back in the 1800s too. So anyway, that's the Congregationalist line, if you like, that would develop out of going back to the Anglican Church and this Puritan separation that came about in the 1600s. We're going to see, Lord willing, we'll get to talking about it next lesson. We'll talk about the evolving of the Baptists. And again, they have their roots in this same area. And they're going to develop a little different. We're going to get reintroduced to the Anabaptists that we talked about previously. And we'll talk about the Baptists then in that. Y'all got any questions that I can so expertly answer like I have so far? Any other tangents you want to go on?
Well, I mean, when are we going to get into the restoration movement? Is that happening?
Oh, yeah. No, it'll happen. You just have to have patience. About less than 19, 20, 21, somewhere like that.
Because you mentioned Stone and Campbell and all
that, the reason I do that is because we get some of these guys, like the Baptist Church, you know, any of them in the modern day, they've all gone from where they started to something that exists through a number of transitions to today.
You got to feel the same frustration in all these people, the reformers feel.